at the close of 2016, after months of protests by thousands of activists, opponents of the Dakota Access Pipeline celebrated when the Obama administration denied a key permit. Then a year ago, the Trump administration reversed course and approved construction. The protests near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, they sparked a global conversation about sacred sites, about land rights, and most importantly, it put a sharper focus on the plight of Native communities. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stephanie Woodard has been reporting on Native American communities for nearly two decades now, and she's the author of the new book, American Apartheid, The Native American Struggle for Self-Determination and Inclusion. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
So your book is titled American Apartheid, and that word apartheid is very strong, a word defined as a policy or system of segregation or discrimination on grounds of race. Why did you choose to use that word?
Well, because it's what I saw. Over the years, as I've reported on various reservations in various years, I noticed two basic things that were consistent countrywide, no matter where I was and no matter who the people were. On the one hand, I saw the vibrancy of the cultures, and on the other hand, it always came up that there were all kinds of economic strictures that the federal government places on Native tribes and people. And there are strictures that manage to be both systemic and haphazard, if you can believe that. They're both very strict and very capricious. And, you know, a lot of us think we know what big government looks like, and we don't like it when government gets too big. But I remember hearing from Chris Stainbrook, who is Oglala, and he's the head of the Indian Land Tenure Foundation in Minnesota. And he calls the situation in Indian country big government gone wild. And there are quite a number of laws and policies and so on that the U.S. government has put in place that create very messy challenges, hurdles for tribes and individual tribal members. And what I found as a journalist was that I had to figure out what they were so I understood the context of what I was looking at and trying to explain to my readers. So they were all sorts of ways of keeping the tribes geographically, economically, and socially separated from the rest of us so that they could be controlled. On the other hand, they were also very messy and inconsistent. And one... Yeah, go ahead.
What laws and policies would be haphazard? Because laws and policies are very deliberate.
Well, they're not in Indian country. One really big one was called the General Allotment Act, or the Dawes Act, and that was a late 1800s law passed by Congress to break up the communally held reservations. They were all communally held at that point before the law, to break them up into separate plots of land. And a judge that I who I was privileged to interview for the book, her name is Sally Ouellette. She's Cherokee, and she's a retired administrative law judge with the Interior Department. And she said that when you're looking at anything to do with economic development in Indian country, all roads lead to the General Allotment Act. And what the act did was, some reservations had already been broken up before the act. A lot were broken up because of the act, but some were ignored altogether and didn't get broken up. And this is something that I found over and over again in looking at all kinds of laws and policies that get implemented in Indian country, is that sometimes they get implemented and sometimes they don't, and sometimes no records are kept and sometimes they're forgotten about. The government, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, is in charge of most of what goes on in Indian country, and it seems to be not always up to the job.
Stephanie, how does the separation and the isolation of Native Americans on reservations, and especially in urban settings, how does that negatively impact their lives and prosperity?
Well, I think that when, let me go back a second to the General Allotment Act, because this directly connects to what you just asked about. The reservations got broken up, and they some of the land got handed out to tribes and tribal members, and the rest of it was declared excess and given or sold to settlers. So if you look at the map of any reservation nowadays, you will see a color-coded map. It looks like a multicolored checkerboard with each color indicating a different type of ownership. So let's say a tribe wanted to build a housing development to provide more housing to its members, to set up some kind of manufacturing facility or some stores. They'd have to sort out who owned what and then deal with every single one of them. But because government records pertaining to Indian country are notoriously faulty and poor and again, haphazard, getting the information could take a very long time. So it becomes very difficult to get anything that people want done, done. Another thing that occurred, one of the reasons the reservations were broken up was because the idea was to make Native people into farmers, just like us, you know, in the European model. However, the federal government, shortly after that act I told you about, took Indian land into trust. So with the federal government involved as a trustee, banks would not make loans to anyone who wanted to farm and use their land as security to get, to build barns and corrals and buy seed and animals and equipment and, you know, all the kinds of things you need to get a farm going. So farming actually, which was the intention, actually decreased in Indian country rather than increasing. And that's another thing that you find over and over again, is that all kinds of government policies have some kind of logic when they're brought up in Washington, but they have no logic on the ground.
And let me just jump in here to say that we are talking with Stephanie Woodard, who is a journalist and author, has reported many years on Native stories, and her new book is called American Apartheid, The Native American Struggle for Self-Determination and Inclusion. Stephanie, give us some numbers here, if you will. Indigenous people have the nation's lowest incomes, lowest wealth. How do you believe the federal government contributes to those grim statistics?
Well, one big way it contributes is the leasing program. Because things got so messed up in terms of making people into farmers, which was the idea of breaking up all that land and putting people on separate plots instead of having them work communally, seasonally, rotationally, because it put them all into separate plots, and then it did one more thing, which made matters even worse, was that for a long period of time, Native people were prohibited from writing wills and designating single or small number of heirs for their property. So what happened was a lot of the property, over the generations, everyone who could inherit did. And that multiplied and multiplied and multiplied until nowadays some of those plots of land that were pointed out in the late 1800s for Native people to own, they are now owned by descendants who may be in the dozens or hundreds, or some plots of land even have thousands of people owning them. So it becomes impossible, because government records tend to be faulty, to know who owns the land
and I need
to what they want to do.
Yeah, Stephanie Woodard is our guide. She reports on Native stories. Her new book is called American Apartheid. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you a member of a tribal nation? What would you like people to know about your circumstances? Tell your story. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the state of Native American lives here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Friday, the first Indigenous People's March on Washington is planned to draw more awareness to Indigenous issues here in the U.S. and around the world. We're looking at a book that shines a light on injustices in Native communities and the perseverance that remains despite the hardship, despite the loss. Stephanie Woodard is guiding our discussion this hour. She's reported on Native communities for nearly two decades. Her new book is called American Apartheid, The Native American Struggle for Self-Determination and Inclusion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a member of a tribal nation? What would you like people to know about your situation? Share your stories with us. Are you concerned about the levels of government control in Native American lives? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie, when you first started covering Native news, you wrote a story about Roseanne Cash's guitar, which brought you all the way to Wisconsin because that is where the wood came from. What did you learn about the foresting practices of the Menominee tribe through that story?
Well, that actually was not something that was the inspiration for everything that followed, but that actually didn't bring me to Wisconsin because I was an editor, and what I was doing was trying to get more environmental coverage into my magazine in New York City. I contacted the Rainforest Alliance. They put me in touch with the Menominees, who have a sustainably harvested forest products company that is actually very widely regarded. I believe it's world renowned. There were many interesting things that they went about in terms of making their various harvesting decisions. So that, in essence, inspired me to write these things myself, not just be an editor sitting back in the office saying, gosh, this looks interesting, but somebody else gets to do this. Mm. I wrote some articles about Pueblo gardening and so on. And one of the things I found was that the Menominees essentially treated their forest, which is a very large thing, as a garden, as a gardener might treat a garden, having a one-to-one relationship with the trees and making all kinds of decisions with all of the forest's inhabitants in mind. And when I talked to engineers from the Rainforest Alliance who had certified it as a sustainably logged forest, and this was way back in the 90s, they raved about its biodiversity and its beauty. They said you could hardly imagine it's ever been touched, and yet over 150 years, they had essentially taken quite a few billion board feet of lumber out of it, had essentially removed the forest three times over, and yet I saw very striking satellite photographs that showed that the Menominee's forest is actually a darker green, a healthy, vibrant green, compared to surrounding areas of land. So it was quite an achievement, and we were very happy to do that story and to have it lead to others.
And before we get into other stories, I want to seize the moment here on the Menominee tribe, because late last year, a federal judge dismissed the lawsuit brought by the Menominee tribe against the federal government that challenged the permitting process for the Back 40 mine project. And that's an open pit sulfide mine proposal for Menominee County in Michigan near the Menominee River. And we want to bring in Doug Cox now to the conversation. He is the tribal chairman for the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. Doug, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Well, looking at the Chairman Cox, looking at the Back 40 mine, why is the land on the banks of the river important to you and the Menominee people?
It's interesting because you just introduced the projects, and a couple of things you said was the Menominee River in Menominee County, Michigan. Those names given to that area is no coincidence for the tribe. That's where literally our beginning lies, that Menominee River, where it flows into Lake Michigan via Green Bay, lies our creation story for the Menominee tribe. Our very beginning begins there in our stories and our culture. That's where we first came on to the land. That area holds great significance to the tribe throughout, as well as it being, you know, in the heart of our original territory. Well before the treaty era, that's where the Menominee lived. That's where the Menominee came from. That is Menominee.
Chairman Cox, for those who may not have that strong ancestral connection to the land, why do you think they should be concerned about the Back 40 mine?
Absolutely. That's a great question. You know, that two-part issue to this project, you know, for Menominee, obviously, you know, we lived and resided there throughout history. Our cultural sites are still there. But for the general public that lives there in that area as well, and anybody that lives around the Great Lakes should have great concern over a project this size. It's a giant open pit mine proposed, 750 feet deep, nearly a quarter mile long, that's going to extract sulfide resources from the ground. And they're, you know, as most of us know that have worked around sulfide mines, that there aren't any that have operated for more than a few years that have been closed and owners walked away from it that have not polluted the environment. They're known for their threats to the environment, for their pollution via acid mine drainage. And this project is a mere, in some places, a mere 50 yards from the bank of the Menominee River. There's going to be environmental disasters up there over time.
Chairman Cox, as you talk about environmental disasters, I really want to bring Marcus from Milwaukee into the conversation. Marcus, what's on your mind?
Good morning. So my thought is that we actually need to have a paradigm shift in our mentality, because we're all clearly making a mistake. I think we need to take and actually look at what Native Americans have been doing for so long, as you're just speaking about, and caring for the earth, because clearly what we've been doing and having private ownership has been causing the problems and got us to the point we're at now with global climate change. And we need to literally, the planet needs to wake up and change our mentality. And Native Americans, Native peoples around the world, I think is a great place to look in the start, because they were doing it for so long before we got here.
Marcus, thank you for those thoughts. Chairman Cox, mine developments like the Back 40 take a lot of planning to become reality. Was the Menominee Nation considered during that process?
And again, a great question, Kate. You know, the differences in Michigan are unique because the Clean Water Act, which usually protects our wetlands and our water resources in the United States, has some conditions in them where states can be granted authority to take on them programs themselves. So in Michigan, the 404 wetland permitting section of the Clean Water Act has been granted and delegated to the state of Michigan. That very delegation in itself excludes the tribe from active participation in this project and being able to come to the table in a government-to-government fashion that we've had to fight from the beginning of this thing to get a place at the table in Michigan, number one. And number two, to have to battle those differences between a tribe in Wisconsin, even though we're a sovereign nation, traveling to Michigan to participate, to challenge, to communicate, and to fight their very policies of, oh, we can only communicate with Michigan tribes. Wisconsin tribes, you stay down there and we'll communicate with you, you know, when we're to that point. Those are the things that have set us back and really concern us about projects like this, and this one particularly at the Back 40.
Stephanie, what do you see when you look at the Back 40 proposal? How have governments and corporations overstepped Native lands, as you see, in recent decades?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I wanted to bring up something that Brett Lee Shelton, who is an Oglala attorney at the Native American Rights Fund, says that often these situations sort of come down to being described as Native people versus development. But what he pointed out was that the projects themselves can be very, very destructive of development. Just as the chairman was saying, there is a lot of destruction is going to go on because of this mine, and it's going to affect Wisconsin as a great outdoor place that a lot of people can enjoy, and it can affect a lot of industries, tourism industries, recreation industries, all kinds of outdoor activities, as well as quality of life, the water that people drink. can all be affected by a mine like this. And as the chairman pointed out, these are very destructive mines, and they often somehow appear for a very short period of time, and then they declare bankruptcy or they do something to leave and leave the mess behind,
and
which
we're gonna,
often has to be cleaned up by the taxpayers.
And we're going to need to pause right there. Doug Cox, thank you so much for your time with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Doug Cox is the tribal chairman of the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. We're talking about the book American Apartheid, The Native American Struggle for Self-Determination and Inclusion. Author Stephanie Woodard stays with us as our guide as we explore a number of these issues at the state of Native Americans, including voting rights, which we'll be talking about later this hour. You have a voice in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about the levels of government control in Native American lives? Let's talk about it. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update on the Ideas Network. Author Stephanie Woodard has learned during her numerous reporting trips to reservations that many non-reservation residents have never visited, even residents who live close to Native American communities. And in that disconnect, they're missing out on so much cultural richness that can be passed down to the next generation. The book is called American Apartheid, The Native American Struggle for Self-Determination and Inclusion. We're talking about the history of Native American communities and the here and now and what tribal members are up against. Your voice is front and center in this conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you believe needs to happen to rectify systematic injustices that impact minorities? What questions do you have about the culture, the communities of Wisconsin's tribal nations? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go back to the phones now with Laura joining us from Wauwatosa. Laura, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I know this is not pertaining to Wisconsin nations, but I'm wondering if you have insight into the proposed wall with 100 kilometers or so being slated to take place on the Tohono O'odham land and how that would affect treaty rights and lands and trusts. And I can listen off the air.
And Laura, you're talking about the proposed border wall along Mexico's border.
Yes.
Stephanie, what do we know there?
Well, we do know that the Tohono O'odhams are very much opposed to the wall crossing their territory. They are, of course, a sovereign nation, and they are mostly in the United States, but like many nations, their borders really didn't have necessarily anything to do with the borders that later emerged after various political tussles between different countries. So some of their nation is indeed in Mexico, and those people are relatives. They go back and forth for all sorts of family celebrations, ceremonies, and so on and so forth. So they're very much opposed to it. And I think that generally Native people across the country have been very, very much opposed to the wall, and they have seen in the family separations and in the incarceration of the children and so on some parallels to what happened to them in history, and indeed what is still happening to them. Native children in the United States are among the most frequently taken into care, put up for adoption, and so on by the different states. So they have a great deal of sympathy for the people who are essentially showing up to ask for asylum. And there are international agreements that the United States has been part of for a very long time that have to do with the proper due process that should occur when people ask for asylum, and they should not be incarcerated. Their children should not be taken away and put in tent cities in Texas and so on, or shipped to very faraway places like places in New England and New York where they're
hundreds or thousands of miles from their parents. So it is a very difficult situation, and it is one that the Tohono O'odhums and many other tribes and tribal members have been very, very opposed to.
Stephanie, as we talk about the political situation, voting rights comes up. It's on the minds of many Americans. And in 2013, the Supreme Court struck down parts of the Voting Rights Act. Voter ID laws have been implemented in a number of states since, including Wisconsin. How has the right to vote been infringed on for Native communities in particular?
Well, they're very much in the throes of their civil rights movement at this very moment. For decades, groups like Four Directions in South Dakota, the Native American Rights Fund in Denver, and the ACLU have brought scores of federal lawsuits to allow Native people equal access to the vote. Usually what comes up in those cases is a question of poverty times distance. Counties, which usually control voting, the very practical part, you know, on the ground activities of voting in this country, will set up precincts far from a reservation population center, so Native people can't get there, or perhaps the county doesn't offer the reservation, the registration days or the early voting days that everyone else in the state gets. And so this can chill the Native vote in a way that can be proven in court to be unequal. And of course, there's also harassment and intimidation that goes on as well. Now, all of this has happened and all of these lawsuits have occurred, but simultaneously, there has been a lot of very vigorous get-out-the-vote activities in tribal communities. And in the last election, as a matter of fact, a very large number of Native candidates were elected to political office. So it does seem to be working, this struggle.
And as we talk here, let's pause and bring in another voice to this conversation. Guy Ryder is a Menominee Indian community organizer and executive director of the Minneconnakim Incorporated. That's a grassroots organization that works to achieve food, language, culture, environmental justice, and energy sovereignty for First Nations people. Guy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So do you see the right to vote being challenged in the Menominee Nation?
Well, you know, on our reservation here, we're pretty spread out within the 234,000 acres that our reservation consists of. There's areas on our reservation where, you know, there's no cell phone service or it's very spotty. So it's quite difficult, you know, to get to certain areas to vote. But, you know, we're trying to do everything we can to help people get to polling places and use their democratic voice.
How has Wisconsin's voter ID law impacted elections in tribal communities, if at all?
Yeah. last year, Governor Walker had signed into law the ability for us to use our tribal IDs in voting and using it in various other places. So I think, you know, in some ways that's actually helped us out a lot better than hurt us.
And you live on the reservation. You're raising your family there. It does seem like the federal government is trying to remedy some of the issues that impact tribes. The CDC has awarded the Menominee tribe some grants to improve county health rankings. Can you explain the tribe's experience when they receive grants like these? Is it getting to the heart of the issues?
Well, you know, I think that we're slowly starting to, you know, understand and figure out, like, exactly our strategies on helping ourselves. You know, a lot of times with these grants, they come with attachments and they come with, you know, ties to them that you have to, you know, look through the filter of the dominant society to apply the grant to the population. I think it would be better if we were able to just have a block of money and use our own cultural filter and our own understanding of who we are to spend the money. So, you know, it's pretty difficult sometimes to navigate some of the grant requirements.
Stephanie, Guy is saying they're using our own cultural filter to spend the money, and that grants come with attachments. Have you seen this?
I haven't dealt with that aspect of Indian country, of specific grants and how they're received and how they're spent and so on. So I really couldn't speak to that issue. What I could say, though, is that what I said at the beginning of the hour, which was that over and over again, I do see in the communities that I visit very strong, vibrant, robust cultures with different ways of thinking about things than mainstream people have. They're equally effective. They get stuff done. I mean, the Menominee Forest Products Company is a good example of that, using very culturally based decision making to do something that is really very excellent, very effective, world renowned. So those things definitely do work. So I could definitely agree with Guy that that local culturally based decision making is a very effective way to get the people involved in doing something that is very good for their future and for the future of their kids.
And Guy, you run a nonprofit on the Menominee Reservation that really looks at food and energy sovereignty. Do you see that you're making inroads there?
You know, I really do believe, you know, we're a relatively new nonprofit. We're about 3 years in. But we really focused on changing the narrative and really been focusing on the way in which that we are told to see ourselves. You know, when you see a lot of signs on the reservation or even in newspapers or on TV, it's all about, you know, what we aren't. And it's always about social ills and how many things are wrong with us, but none of it really focuses on our strengths and who we are. You know, one thing that we have always been really good at is adaptability. And our tribes here, you know, have been able to endure god-awful things, but yet here we are. Here we are still here and speaking our language and practicing our culture. So to me, that says that that's an amazing strength. And we should be focusing on that strength and building on that strength rather than focusing on things that we aren't.
Well, Guy, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Guy Ryder is a Menominee Indian community organizer. He's executive director of Minneconakim. That's a grassroots organization that works to achieve food and energy sovereignty for First Nations people. Author Stephanie Woodard stays with us in this conversation, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What issues stand out to you that need to be addressed when we talk about Native communities? Do you live near a reservation? What do you want to know about life on the reservation? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in just a minute on the Ideas Network.
Here's what the weather looks like for the next few days. Some fog this morning and a few icy spots still on the roads, becoming partly cloudy with highs from the mid-20s to the low 30s. Mostly cloudy skies for Thursday with highs from the upper 20s to low 30s. Friday, cloudy. The southern part of the state will start getting snow flurries in the evening, highs in the 20s. And on Saturday, snow in much of the state. The south might see 1 to 4 inches of accumulation, windy and colder, highs in the upper teens to mid-20s.
Coming up, it's a tough time for brick-and-mortar stores. We get an update on the situation at Wisconsin-based Shopko as it prepares to shutter dozens of stores across the country. That's after 7. Journalist Stephanie Woodard has spent the better part of 2 decades reporting on Indian country for many publications, and her new book is called American Apartheid, The Native American Struggle for Self-Determination and Inclusion. So on this bright fall day, we go with her on a buffalo hunt, and she takes us through the customs, including eating the raw liver of that fallen buffalo. Stephanie chews and swallows a chunk of that raw liver, and you're along in this conversation as we look at the state of the Native American experience and glimpses of hope for the future at 800-642-1234. You can join us. Stephanie, let's go back to that buffalo hunt, and as you watch a buffalo being taken, and the rich ceremonies that happen as they work with that buffalo corpse. Can you take us there?
Sure. It was another bright fall day on the Standing Rock Reservation, and this was years, more than a decade, before Standing Rock became famous for its objection to the oil pipeline crossing the Missouri. A buffalo was chosen, and a sharpshooter from the tribe, because they would always want to kill the buffalo just outright and not let it run away wounded or anything like that. A sharpshooter from the tribe took the buffalo, and then it was broken down, field dressed, in essence, by a number of people. And the first people who, it was interesting for me to see that the first people who worked on the buffalo were the adults, naturally. They're the ones with experience and knew what was going on. And there were a number of children, some first grade classes and some kids from a Boys and Girls Center, who had come along to watch. And the kids kind of hung back at first because they were used to seeing deer broken down, but breaking down a buffalo is a little more unusual. They're an animal that was very close to extinction because of the killing of the vast buffalo herds that was sponsored by the federal government and taken part in by many people, the cavalry, many other people, took apart the buffalo herds, killed off the buffalo because the feeling was, I think it was President Jackson who said, kill the buffalo and you kill the native commissary. So in other words, you get rid of how they ate and how they made their shelters and so on, so you get rid of them, which was the focus of the United States government for a long time. And anyways, the kids were used to seeing smaller animals taken apart, but not really anything quite as big as a buffalo. But gradually, after about half an hour, the kids started to take part, to help out, to, you know, pull a section of skin back so that the adult could remove it or what have you.
They got to look at the stomach.
Yes. Well, that was an interesting part of it. It was the children learning what this thing is and how it works. So kids would ask all kinds of questions like, is this a vein? Is that the stomach? What's that green stuff in it? And the adults could explain. And the man who was vice chairman of the tribe at the time, he's now chairman, Mike Faith, said to me that it's so important for children, and this is true of all children, to learn in the place where the knowledge arose. If they're learning about a tree and they're learning it in the classroom, it has less vividness for them, less personal heart feeling for them than if they learned it in front of the tree itself. And so the same with the buffalo, finding out how it's made, looking at all the different parts of it, touching it, was really important for the kids because they could love the thing, they could feel that when they grew up they would protect the thing, and so on. And I think that that's something that a lot of environmentalists have said about our own children, that if we just tell them about the environment and the climate and things like that in the classroom, they know those as sort of very abstruse sort of concepts. They don't know them about they don't know them as real things that affect their lives. But if they learn those things out in a forest, out in a field, it makes sense to them in a much more real way.
And there were a lot of ceremonial things that happened with this buffalo, the tobacco and the nostrils, and then also the liver.
Well, I don't know if the liver was the tobacco. Yes, there was a blessing at the very beginning. I don't know if the liver was
ceremonial, perhaps it was.
Or just a delicacy.
I don't know, but it was considered a delicacy.
Sure.
So it was divided up among all those who were present, and we all got to eat a piece of raw liver, which was a new experience for me, I have to say. And just so your listeners know, it's kind of metallic and sweet tasting, and it's sort of custardy crunchy because I think there are a lot of arteries or veins or something in it. So it was a bit of a new experience, but I did manage to eat it.
What was interesting too was the leanest cuts of the meat were going to the children and the people managing their diabetes.
Yes. What the diabetes program was. Along with the Fish and Game Department, were organizing this event. And what happened with the lean cuts of meat was that they went back to the diabetes program, which mixed them with wild berries, like choke cherries and things like that. And they were given out to diabetes patients because it had been found that eating that was nutritious, but it didn't send the blood sugar soaring. So it was something that they could assimilate in a healthy fashion.
Getting back to the present, what did all of this reporting you've done, how did you look at the lens of Standing Rock in 2016 with the context of the reporting that you had done in Indian Country on Native communities?
Well, one of the things that I have noticed actually very recently is that Standing Rock, which, as you say, occurred over the course of 2016, made a really big change in the way the media looks at Indian Country. All sorts of media outlets eventually showed up. First, it was really just social media. That was how anyone got information about what was going on there. But eventually, big-time media outlets of all sorts showed up, and their readers and listeners and viewers became aware of Native people and their concerns. And so recently, what I've noticed is that when the federal government shutdown occurred, a range of stories included tribes and reservations as among those affected, and I don't think that would have occurred before 2016. It wasn't as though those ideas would have been rejected. They just would never have come to mind at all. And in some cases, articles I've seen in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so on, have discussed the shutdown's effect on Indian Country in passing, in general. But there were also in-depth stories. I noticed an NPR story on the shutdown's particular effect on health care on reservations. In many of the treaties, tribes traded land for services like education and health care. So there are clinics, there are hospitals, their medications depend on federal money and federal workers, and all of that is at a standstill during the federal government shutdown. I heard part of some testimony before Congress. I believe it was the Senate. No, there were actually House members there. So anyway, before Congress yesterday, and people were talking about the fact that some people are going to run out of very important medications at the end of the month. So there are lives at stake in the shutdown. And there are also lives at stake in, for example, the national parks. Apparently, 7 people have died because there's no one to help them out, no one to look over them in the federal parks. So I think that Standing Rock really made big difference in getting a lot of media outlets and therefore their followers to cover Indian Country in a really serious way.
Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephanie Woodard has been reporting on Native American communities for nearly 2 decades. She's the author of the new book, American Apartheid, The Native American Struggle for Self-Determination and Inclusion. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.